This panel is flood, sweat, and fears, climate change, and extreme weather events. And the panel, we've got a distinguished panel. To my right, Margaret Davidson of NOAA, the Coastal Services Division Chief. To her right, Carrie Emanuel of MIT in Meteorology, Earth Science Department. To his right, Charlene Lurig of Ceres, who is in charge of their insurance program. And to her right, Hal Wanless of our host University of Miami Geosciences Department. So we're talking about extreme events here. And if you lived here 20 years ago, like Angela and I did, 7,000 days ago, 6,998 to be precise, if you went downstairs, you'd be underwater. That was the day Hurricane Andrew hit South Florida. Now, it hit harder and worse in Homestead.
No, just that I remember the
Here you go.
Yeah. I remember the sailing ships that are out there in Biscayne Bay. They ended up in the middle of the street here, carried out by the water. So that, for me, was incredibly powerful.
And the reason we're talking about Andrew isn't just because we're here in South Florida, where Andrew hit, and as a Category 5 hurricane, mind you. But Andrew was the start of a series of lots of hurricanes. And actually, it was when I started doing disasters. That year, all three National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration hurricane centers, Hawaii, Miami, and Guam, were hit by hurricanes. Same year. That year, there were so many disasters that I did a magazine piece for the Sun Sentinel on the year the weather went wild. I did that story again last year. I did that story again this August. Each of you has a disaster at the table. Each of them are individual. They are from 2011. These are disasters that occurred this year. Most of these disasters killed people. The point of these disasters on these sheets is that natural disasters can happen anywhere, anytime, and they're happening more frequently. We want you to experience what it's like to be through a disaster. But when it comes to experiencing life through disaster, it really isn't fun. It's a very difficult thing. And no one has experienced it quite as much as Mark Schliefstein. Mark is going to tell us a bit about Hurricane Katrina. And by the way, the slides you saw as you came in, these were Mark's slides.
Thanks, sir. I'm actually not going to talk about the disaster as much as about what SCJ meant to me living through that disaster. I had sent out a message when it looked like we were going to lose our power, and within minutes, Beth Park with SCJ sent out a message to the listserv explaining what was going on and urging people to basically take care of us. And in the days and weeks that followed, that's exactly what happened. Our temporary newsroom in Baton Rouge was inundated with gifts of everything from deodorant and soap to clothes and everything else that we needed, and it was largely due to SCJ members that helped us out. SCJ is a family, and it's a family of us. And because of that, I also want to add another $500 challenge grant to our challenge today. So please, people, fill these things out.
All right, now to the people who study what Mark has gone through. Carrie Emanuel made a lot of news about 2 months before Katrina, or even less. I think it was a month before Katrina hit, with his paper in Nature. Was it Nature or Science? Nature. Telling us that we are getting more hurricanes. They're stronger because of climate change. So from MIT, Dr. Carrie Emanuel.
Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
So I study hurricanes, and we became concerned about some very interesting changes we've seen, particularly in Atlantic hurricanes over the last few years. It motivated us to publish the paper that Seth alluded to before Hurricane Katrina happened. So just to get this started, you probably are aware that tropical cyclones occur in all the world's oceans, although only about 10% of them occur in the North Atlantic. Most of the storms in the world occur in the Pacific and Indian Oceans. So they're a problem throughout the world, but I will focus on the storms in the Atlantic today. Charlene will tell you a little bit more about the effect of natural disasters in the insurance industry, but this one slide tells you that almost 80% of insured losses around the world are due to wind, and most of those are due to hurricanes. So it's a big problem for the insurance business as well as others. Now, this is a chart showing damages due to hurricanes in the United States in every decade of the 20th century up through the first decade of ours. And the only thing that's been done to adjust these numbers is to 2004 dollars. You can see that there's this huge increase in hurricane damages. Now, a lot of that is driven by demographics, by a massive lemming-like migration of people to the coastline that sets us up for disasters. That's all about very unwise policy here in the United States. That's a bit of a different topic. But some of this is also due to changing hurricane activity. This slide shows that somewhat more graphically. So the red curve that you see on this chart is a measure of the power of Atlantic hurricanes. It's literally something quite like the destructive potential of hurricanes. And the blue curve simply shows the temperature of the tropical Atlantic where hurricanes form during hurricane season. And you can see that there's a correlation between the two, which is something we pointed out 6 years ago. That correlation continues. It's actually improved in the 6 years that went by between when that paper was published and now. So as the Atlantic continues to warm, we expect this to get worse. You notice that there was a hurricane drought in the U.S. in the 70s and 80s. This is also a really bad thing in some ways because it's precisely during that time that a lot of coastal development occurred. This chart just shows the tropical Atlantic Ocean temperature since about the end of the 19th century and the whole northern hemisphere surface temperature in August through October, simply to make a very fundamental point that on these timescales, there's nothing special about the tropical Atlantic. It's doing the same thing the rest of the northern hemisphere is doing. And so if we want to make a projection, we better understand why it seesawed like that. Well, we think we understand that, and that has to do with a lot of modeling that was done and other work in connection with the last IPCC report. The upper chart shows the global mean temperature going back 100 years in black, attempts to model that with global models and shades there. And then the cause of the temperature changes in the models is shown at the bottom. There are a lot of different things going on, solar changes, volcanoes, sulfate aerosols, which are a cooling effect, very important, it's man-made, and greenhouse gases. And you can see the uptick in the last 20 or 30 years is almost entirely due to the greenhouse gases. We know that the globe and the northern hemisphere are doing different things, and this shows that. The red is the globe, the blue is the northern hemisphere. The light blue curve are sulfate aerosols, which come from fossil fuel combustion. We think that the cooling of the northern hemisphere and the tropical Atlantic in the 70s and 80s was mostly driven by human effects. So I'm here to tell you that not only have we probably caused the uptick in ocean temperature in Atlantic hurricanes in the last 20 or 30 years, but we also caused the hurricane drought of the 70s and 80s unwittingly. So let me just wrap things up. Tropical cyclones are responsible for the majority of insured losses worldwide. Atlantic hurricane power has more than doubled since the 1980s. This is a big change. The hurricane power tracks the tropical ocean temperature in the summertime, and that ocean temperature seems to be controlled mostly by what we call radiative forcing, which in recent 50 years or so has included two important man-made influences, aerosol pollution, hazes basically, which cool the planet, and greenhouse gases that warm it. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie. Now, those of us who live on or near the coast know that hurricanes are our particular cross to bear. But you don't necessarily have to be coastal to get the worst of a hurricane, as Irene showed us this year. Not to tell a story out of school, but there was an editor at AP who was wondering why there was not coastal evacuations in Vermont for Hurricane Irene. Had to explain, you sort of need a coast. But these disasters are truly coastal oriented on the most part, and Margaret is NOAA's expert on all coastal.
Well, I'm one of NOAA's experts on coastals, but my bona fides are actually very different. I grew up in Fort Worth, which when I was growing up was the southern end of Tornado Alley, although Tornado Alley has shifted to the southeast. And my maternal DNA ran from New Orleans to Pascagoula, Mississippi, so my adolescence and late adolescence was misspent on the Redneck Riviera. And then in 1980, I moved from New Orleans to Charleston so that I could be on high ground, 8 feet above sea level. So as I like to say, it's personal, it's not just professional. I cleaned up after Camille in 1969, Celia in 70, ran a disaster field office in South Louisiana in 73, 74. So, and 70% of FEMA's repetitive losses are due to coastal flooding. Now, why is this? Carrie mentioned that we're like lemmings to the sea. Of course, we have been like lemmings to the sea since humans began with settlements because of the proximity of water, food, transportation, and waste disposal. But more importantly, because of that population increase in the U.S., about 50% of our population lives on 20% of the land and generates about 60% of GDP. Roger Pilkey Jr. from Colorado published a paper a couple of years ago that said if the Long Island Express of 38 were to have hit again in 3 years ago, it would have been the first $100 billion disaster in the U.S. because of not just changes in population density, but changes in property value and changes in the dollar value. Now, of course, it might decrease slightly since 2008, now that I think about it. But the point is that there are a lot of people with a lot of assets at risk. Foolish people live everywhere, but a lot of them live on the coast. And in the good old days, we only had to worry about the water coming in by sea, the storm surge. But one of the interesting phenomena, particularly of the last decade, is that storms, not just extratropicals that Carrie spoke about, but all types of storms are much more pregnant with precipitation. So on the coast, we not only have to worry about the water coming in by sea, but as these storms move up the watershed, they're dropping more precipitation. 20 to 35% more precipitation than they did a decade ago. So since we're also downstream, and you know what happens with things flowing downstream, we now have to worry about the flood that's coming to us on the backside. And in many cases, the flooding coming back down the river is much greater than the storm surge has been coming in from sea. So this is one of the concerns that we have about storms and the changes in precipitation patterns, the changes in storm patterns in the future. Now, why FEMA cannot change its designation of the floodplains, because Congress has to approve it, we all know that the aerial extent of flooding is much greater than it was even a decade ago. And some people can speak to that. As a colleague of mine says, who is actually a natural resource manager in a small mid-Atlantic state, today's flood is tomorrow's high tide. So, you know, we do cost-benefit analysis. When we set up cost-benefit analysis 30 years ago, we steeply discounted the future. But I would submit to you that there's no reason now to so steeply discount the future when the future is, in fact, not 5 decades from now, but it is here and occurring in the next couple of decades. Jim Hansen has a website about 21 feet by 2100. I recommend that you Google it. It's incredibly provocative. And the final comment I want to make is that when we talk about losses, the thing you need to understand is the loss record is incredibly inaccurate and a great underestimate, because it is only the documented private and public insurance and cash outlays. And there's absolutely nothing about the environmental or the social costs. Many of which are borne at the local government level, not reimbursed by the state house or by Uncle Sugar. So we need to also not only understand these implications, but we need to begin a discussion about what this means, particularly since we've seen the House Republicans not even want to pay for disaster losses in the way that we have historically off budget, so it was funny money. Now they remember they wanted to have an offset out of the discretionary programs, which are themselves only 12% of the budget. So the challenge is that, like that old Parquet commercial, you can't fool Mother Nature. And our costs are mounting, even as our fiscal resources are increasingly constrained. And there's a huge social justice issue in this whole issue as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret. Now, here in Miami, we have our own little special problems that are made only worse because the ocean is last lapping at our feet and perhaps a little higher as time goes on. And that issue runs into a sister issue of climate change extremes, which is sea level rise. And which goes back to what Margaret says of the 21 feet by 2100. And Hal Wanless at the University of Miami will tell us a little bit about Miami and sea level rise and disasters.
Thank you. It's nice to be here today. Jim Hansen's probably right, and that's what I want to show you. And that's very disturbing. Accelerating sea level rise actually began at the end of the, or beginning of the Industrial Revolution. You can see a pronounced increase in the global rate of rise beginning about 1930. We're presently running at about a rate of about 30 centimeters a foot per century. Most of the rise to this point has been because of warming and thermal expansion of the ocean. Miami happens to have about the same rate as the global rise, but being a local area, there's more variability. For instance, the relaxed winds during the 97 El Nino, you can see how the Atlantic Ocean sloshed a little bit. Sea level went down temporarily. There are other places like New York to Savannah that have about an extra foot rise because they're subsiding, or the Mississippi Delta that is subsiding more over to Galveston, that are running about 3 feet per century. The 2001 projection from the IPCC is there, and the sea level by satellite altimetry shows that we are running at the upper end of the projections. When the fourth IPCC report came out in 2007, I was chair of the science committee of the Miami-Dade County's Climate Change Advisory Task Force, and within a month or two, we put out a statement because their reduced projection of sea level ignored what was beginning to become apparent in Greenland, a rapid ice melt. We proposed a 3 to 5 foot by the end of the century. We said there is a possibility of a catastrophically rapid melt of landbound ice from Greenland. And ours and all other projections recognize that wherever we are by the end of the century, we will be just into this rise that will continue throughout the next century and beyond. Since that time, it's our projections, 3 to 5 feet, are sort of middle of the road. In 2009, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was directed to incorporate sea level into all their civil works planning, past, present, and future. This is their projections, low end, high end, 2 to 5 feet, basically, by the end of the century. And last year, the Southeast Florida counties, the Regional Planning Council, have incorporated this rise for our planning here. I would suggest you look at the upper end of that because of the accelerating ice melt that we're seeing on both Greenland and Antarctica. And it's important that you leave here understanding wherever we are at the end of the century, sea level will be accelerating. If we're at plus 5 feet, say, sea level will be rising at a rate of a foot per decade. Try to manage New York ports with that kind of situation. But let's come closer to home. Here's South Florida. You can see Turkey Point Nuclear Power Plant, the Everglades, Miami, Cape Romano, Cape Sable. For reference, Everglades City and Chokoloskee. The white area is the urbanized area. The blue is the wettest part of the Everglades. With a 2 foot rise, we will have lost our wetlands, and we will have further increased flooding on Miami Beach and the low-lying areas in the western part of the county. We will have trouble keeping the low-lying western area deflooded because fresh water has to be higher than seawater to prevent saltwater intrusion. Turkey Point is now our nuclear power plant, where they want to build 2 new structures to meet the growing population here. We'll now be an island offshore. With a 4 foot rise, we start to have a problem. All the barrier islands of the world will be abandoned, as will most of the deltas becoming abandoned. Loss of people, place, loss of agriculture, place. We down here will have a complete loss of freshwater resources. With a 5 foot rise, we now have the Everglades estuary that can send storm surges up on both sides now. And we will have a total infrastructure collapse. We lost MIA, Miami International Airport, and our billion-dollar tunnel somewhere around this time or just before. And we have, which we'd never think about, increased pollution risks from the inundation and erosion of polluted industrial sites and dumps and so on. And if this is where we are at the end of the decade, end of the century, we'll be rising at a foot per decade. And very simply, at this point, Miami-Dade County, Broward, Monroe County are diminished and risky places to live. One of my colleagues, an architect, said, wow, we'll have very high property values when we're up 6 feet. No, this is going to be a very undesirable and risky place to live. And on top of what I just showed you, those are seasonal high water levels. But on top of that, we all have these exceptional tides. I wish you were going to be here next week when we are having our higher tides of the year. I tried to get them to move the conference, but they wouldn't. So, because this is what many places in Miami and Miami Beach look like, okay? And on top of what I showed you, you also have to include the hurricane surges, which we are right in Hurricane Alley here, and we will get plenty more. And at what point do you say enough is enough? That's the Boulevard Peninsula, just east of Galveston after Ike. Okay, if that's all that happens, that's the good news. The bad news is that we have so tipped the atmosphere with greenhouse gases that we are probably headed toward a rise of 20, 40, 60 feet before our environment equilibrates. The worst news is that this may happen much faster than we're presently anticipating. That picture is the last interglacial on the left, 120,000 years ago, when sea level was up 20 feet. Then we moved into an ice age, the coldest part of which, sea level was down 420 feet. Chicago was under a mile of ice, et cetera, as we were in the depths of the ice age. What I want to just spend a couple slides on is showing you how we got from that low sea level to where we are today. The typical graph is connecting the dots of all the carbon 14 dates, looks like this, where it picked up from minus 120 meters and went fast, slowed down a little bit, went fast, and then about 7,000 years slowed down and toward our present level, okay? That's not how it happens. What happens is when sea level, when climate becomes unstable, there will suddenly be a rapid collapse of ice somewhere, and you'll have a rapid pulse of rise and then a pause, okay? And as you look around the shelf, the continental shelves around the world, you see abandoned barrier islands, abandoned tidal inlet sand complexes, and abandoned reefs that were just growing and then were suddenly drowned by one of these rapid rises of sea levels. These are very well documented. There are a number of them shown here. And that's how sea level worked in the past. That's how sea level worked on the Paleozoic rocks I work on in the Grand Canyon. And that's how sea level will change if we destabilize climate in the future. And so don't think of this. Think of things going wrong and you suddenly have a rapid rise and erosion and inundation. And it's a muddy mess after one of those pulses. Will there be significant rapid pulses of sea level rise in the future? Yes. And it's possible we're seeing the beginning now. All the modelers say there's no way to forecast these things, so obviously people are now trying. This is from Jim Hansen's book, Storms of Our Grandchildren. And the point, I've added the little arrows on the right. You know, we have seriously tipped the climate. And that's just the CO2, not the nitrous oxide and methane and chlorofluorocarbons, all of which are powerful greenhouse gases. We must expect a serious ice melt and sea level response in the same way as it has happened in the past, okay? And what we're seeing since the mid-90s is an accelerating melt of ice from both Greenland and Antarctica. These are a 17% acceleration in the net melt rate and a 5% acceleration in the contribution to sea level rise. Since the mid-90s, we've been seeing these earthquakes in Greenland and Antarctica at the outlet glacial sites. And these are as sort of like popping the cork on the on your champagne bottle and then rapid flowing after. This is how things happen. At first, we were admiring the warming atmosphere doing most of this melting on Greenland and so on, but we now understand it is the warm North Atlantic, the warm Arctic, and the warm Southern Ocean moving in under these outlet glaciers that is rapidly melting the and pouring ice out to the sea. The most disturbing one of all, I think, right now, and Antarctica is a remote place to work, but the work being done around the major outlet glacier for the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, the Pine Island Glacier. It's thinning at a dramatic rate. They now have, through airplanes and remote gadgets they've sent in underneath, they now realize that the water has gotten in over 60 kilometers under that ice sheet and is creating an estuarine circulation that is rapidly accelerating melt. The increased winds predicted by global warming are driving water in under here. This is happening on Greenland. This is almost an unlimited source of heat energy as our oceans have been warming to keep this up. If you look underneath, if I can get this to advance. Can you advance the next slide? If you look underneath, especially Antarctica, but also Greenland, the weight of the ice has pushed the land below sea level. We could have that melting process dramatically rise our sea level without all the icebergs flowing out. This process of estuarine circulation or estuarine-like circulation underneath here may be the beginning of one of these rapid rises. So my suggestion is we should not look at 5 or 6 feet by the end of the century. We should start thinking about rapid pulses in the 1 to 10 meter range in the near future. I cannot define that, but it could well be within this century. And could you advance the next one, please? And I would suggest that we start thinking about implementing and putting things that we don't want to lose, like World Seed Banks and National Archives and Libraries, and are too valuable to be disrupted, say military bases, somewhere above any potential real sea level rise. We're not going to melt all the ice, but we could easily have a 100-foot rise. We're at a CO2 level about where that map is right now. But I would recommend this. And as I close, I would invite you all, as residents of Dade County, to come up where we are, because we're higher than you, as sea level slowly rises. Note that when sea level in Dade County is at plus 6 feet, we have lost almost half the land, and 73% of what remains is less than 2 feet above sea level. Thank you very much. Next slide.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hal. Now, there is no such thing as a free lunch. We do pay for this. You pay for it in your insurance rates. And Charlene Oreg, is it Cirrus, which is... It's hard to describe, but she will tell us a lot about how we're paying for it and how we're actually paying a lot for it.
Thanks. So I'll give you that weather is weird, right? You just have to look around at weather.com or your daily weather report and find out that the weather looks maybe weirder than usual. But I guess the question is, if you want to add it all up and see if this whole climate change thing is actually what's behind it, who do you really listen to anymore? Because I've been hearing rumors that people like Carrie and Hal are just in it for these sweet government grants. And folks like Margaret are just feds who don't know what to do except spend money. So who do you listen to? Well, it turns out that insurers are also saying that climate change is real. How do we know this? We know this because Lloyd's of London, the grandfather of modern insurance, says that it's real and says that human activities are contributing to it. But then again, they're British, and so that's just a hair shy of socialism. AIG also says it's real and says that human activity is contributing to it, but they took down the global economy. So you might not want to buy stock in them. But it turns out several dozen other insurance companies here in the United States also think climate change is real. And the reason we know that is because they had to tell their regulators what they thought about climate change. And we have a report up here that says what those insurance companies are saying. And one of them is PMA Group. It's a mid-size insurance company in Pennsylvania that says, not only do we think climate change is real and is going to make extremes more extreme, we actually worry that it's going to outstrip the capacity of the insurance industry to manage losses. And we are hearing this from more and more insurance companies. In fact, the CEO of Allstate, the country's second largest insurance company, told financial analysts earlier in this year on a quarterly earnings call that his company thinks that whatever this new normal is, this weather that we're seeing is the new normal, and they're starting to change their business accordingly. So why do insurers think climate change is real? Well, it's because they've started losing a lot of money assuming that things aren't changing. Right? 2005 happened, and the industry saw the losses that Katrina yielded, and it started asking the question, what could climate change mean for hurricane losses? Could it mean that hurricanes are going to become more intense, more frequent? Many companies, including Allstate, decided we don't really want to stick it out on the coasts to find out the answer. So they picked up their business and they moved inland. And a couple of years went by, and the weather was weird, but it wasn't anything that the industry couldn't handle. And then 2011 came along. And 2011 is the year that the industry found out that there is nowhere to hide. Because it was the year that they learned that a single tornado in Joplin, Missouri could cause $3 billion in losses. That 3 days of tornado activity in the Midwest could cause $7 billion in losses. A single wildfire in Texas could destroy $250 million worth of value. And that hurricanes indeed could make their way all the way up to Vermont, which isn't a coastal state as we learned earlier today. So if the industry recognizes that climate change is real and starts changing their business accordingly, what does that mean for all of us? Well, it means that the U.S. is probably going to start looking a lot more like Florida. See, in 1992, when Hurricane Andrew hit Florida, insurers decided they didn't really like the risk anymore. And they didn't really like that policymakers in the state who were so anxious to keep those property tax revenues rolling in by allowing development anywhere people wanted to build and to keep insurance rates low in order to facilitate that, they didn't want to be part of that game. So they exited the market in droves. And today, the largest insurance company in the state of Florida is the state of Florida. And the liability that the state holds is so huge that everyone knows that the next time the big one rolls in, the system will bankrupt itself. And unfortunately, it's not just Florida. State after state is moving in the direction of Florida. Massachusetts, Texas, the Carolinas, you name it, you look at a coastal state, and more states are assuming the liability as private carriers exit the market. And it's not just wind risk. It's as hard today to get wildfire coverage in the state of California as it is to get wind coverage on Cape Cod. And next year, when folks in Missouri decide that they want to renew their homeowners policy, they might find it's very hard to get tornado coverage as well. So who ends up holding all the risk if the private market is fleeing? It's taxpayers. And who is on the hook when a 20-foot wall of water hits those homes in Florida? It's you and me because of the National Flood Insurance Program. Because today in the United States, private carriers don't write flood insurance for homes. The federal government writes those policies. Today, the federal government has $1 trillion worth of flood liabilities across the U.S. The NFIP is $20 billion in debt because of Hurricane Katrina, and we'll probably see those numbers go up once we tabulate all the losses from the Mississippi floods this year and from Hurricane Irene. So the 7 inches of sea level rise that Miami-Dade County is planning for over the next 20 years means that the more frequently that Walmarts and luxury hotels start getting flooded out, not only will it be likely that private carriers recuse themselves from the personal lines, they'll no longer want to write commercial flood either. And then the question is, who holds that risk? And that's a bleak future. It's a bleak future for us because it means we don't actually have the money available to adapt to climate change, to adapt to more intense droughts and floods and wildfires, because we're just burning through GDP trying to recover from the last disaster just to encounter the next one. Right? But it's a bleak future for insurance companies, too, because as they retreat to wherever they think the risk is profitable, they're going to be clawing each other's eyes out trying to get at that market, right, as the market itself shrinks. But there's another future that we can actually create. It's a future that we can create with the insurance industry if our politicians and our business leaders recognize that the insurance industry is not with us for the long haul if we decide to keep going down the high carbon path. We're in that on our own. And if insurance CEOs and shareholders actually want to stay profitable and stay in business, they have to start figuring out how they partner with us to build a low-carbon future and to build resilience to the embedded climate effects that we're already encountering. The insurance industry controls $23 trillion in assets globally. Today, a lot of those assets are invested in oil sands, in carbon-intensive energy sources like coal. They're putting their investment dollars in the things that are sowing the seeds of their own destruction. They have to change that path along with us. So that is our choice. It's a choice we can make with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlene. I'm just going to ask one question of the panel, and then we're going to invite questions here. Of course, the usual rules, SEJ members, working journalists first, come up to the microphones and identify yourself. But before I ask a question, one thing is, when I prefaced this, I told you about the disaster stories that I've done, the year in disasters. Last year when I did this, 2010 is the year the Earth went wild. AP still has those amazing thing people called librarians, although I think they prefer to call themselves news research centers at this moment. And a woman in Charlotte, North Carolina, Julie Reed Bell, who actually got the double byline on this story, spent months for me compiling every disaster she could find worldwide in 2010. I asked her to do this. I figured I'd have two, three pages. This document is 64 pages long. Each disaster is no more than 5 or 6 sentences at most. 64 pages long. Then she did one for me in mid-2011. It's about 30 or 40 pages long. The disasters that you have on your table are all from 2011, all her work, except for the $10 billion disasters, which is a record that NOAA keeps. These are weather disasters from NOAA that this year in the United States alone that cost more than $1 billion each. This include Irene, they include all the tornadoes that Charlene talked about and more. Include the blizzard of Groundhog's Day, the New Year, but not the New Year's Eve blizzard. I think that one was a different one. So if you want those, drop me your card. I just couldn't print out copies of the 64-page one, but I'd be happy to share these with you. Also, Ceres has a list brochure right here on climate risk disclosure by insurers. Authored by Charlene. So they are here at the table, at the podium if you want. So for the panelists here, let us look 20 years down the line when SEJ returns to what's left of Miami. And there will be all sorts of disasters, obviously, that'll be happening that year. I want what you think is the most unusual or devastating disaster that you think around that time period that we'll be seeing that we could trace to climate change. I mean, obviously right now, by the way, the standard scientists will tell you you cannot attribute any single one of these disasters to climate change. It's just that we get more of them. We get them more extreme. The funny thing, though, by the way, is there is a new and growing field of climate analysis called attribution studies that is looking to, in the future, develop ways to attribute individual disasters to climate change. Unfortunately, the latest disaster they attributed to climate change was this year when they attributed the 2003 flood heat wave of England. So they don't really work on journalist deadlines. So, Margaret, you want to tell us what you think the worst you'll see in 20 years here?
Well, first let me say about attribution, and certainly my PhD colleagues know a lot more about it than I do, but attribution is a very complex modeling problem. And I'll also remind you that it took over 30 years for us to prove that there was a causal relationship between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. Okay, so. We're working on it, but, you know, scientists feel very strongly about uncertainty issues. I think the thing that's the most troubling to many of us in this field is we're also seeing the stacking up of disasters, the cascading disasters. Now, it also involved a non-weather-related phenomena, but what happened in Japan is a great example of how you have one disaster that you think that you're prepared for, but it in turn precipitates a number of other disasters. And there's a field of literature about this, these cascading disasters, and how that will likely be what cripples our ability to respond and recover. And just one more quick point since I got the mic. Right now, in terms of how we tend to respond to disasters, we often, in our haste to rebuild, exacerbate our future risk. We need to take a wholly different approach towards disaster response and recovery. Charlene mentioned the word resilient earlier today. We were talking about how do we make resilience a more common concept, commonly understood concept that's part of our economic and social stability. So I think you all have something to offer there.
Actually, before we go to Carrie, if you could get this mic. Okay. Before we go to Carrie, you raised this interesting point. In the field that you're talking about where the technological disasters, the really unusual ones, the phrase in the community is the black swan event. Mm-hmm. You know, that you don't normally see a black swan, so you don't really plan on a black swan. But these are called black swan events. As we get more climate change, more extremes in natural disasters, will they trigger more black swans?
Well, I think it's likely, and the only time I ever cite Rumsfeld is that we really need to be prepared for the unknown unknowns.
Carrie.
That was actually a good introduction to what I was going to say, Seth, because my colleagues and I have been very interested in black swan hurricanes, even if the climate doesn't change. And what we've heard is that even if the climate doesn't change, we have a big hurricane problem, and it's partially policy driven, that we have a set of policies in place that essentially underwrite risk. And say, if you want to build a flimsy condo on the beach, go ahead, we'll underwrite your insurance, we'll bail you out when you get destroyed, and people take advantage of that. They're not stupid, I'd say. They're smart. It's the policies that are not happy. So to look at a concrete black swan of many that my colleagues and I are worried about, I'll choose one at random, is Tampa across the state. Okay, Tampa is much more susceptible to very large storm surges than Miami, but it gets fewer hurricanes than Miami does. But and it's been since, I think, the 1920s that there was a really severe hurricane in Tampa. And, of course, most of you know what's happened to the population of that city in the meantime. But our modeling suggests that it is not too hard to get a storm surge of 40 feet in Tampa without climate change, without climate change. Does anybody really think in this room that Tampa is prepared for an event like that? There are not too many places where you can run and hide in the state of Florida from a surge of that magnitude. And so we have our hands full. And as I think, Seth, you alluded to, climate change just makes that worse. It makes the black swan, the one in 500-year event that most of us really don't want to worry about, into something more like a one in 100-year event. And so there's a point to understanding how these black swans were. I could go on and on of examples like that that are off people's radar scopes. That's another definition of black swan that are really frightening and could happen according to the scientific principles as we know them.
And Charlene, wouldn't those of us on the Northeast coast or the Mid-Atlantic coast, you know, those horrible scaremongers in the media said Irene was going had the potential to be an amazingly high-cost disaster. And it obviously wasn't as high-cost as it could have been. It was only a Category 1, although it carried a lot more water in flooding. And, of course, for those of you who don't follow hurricanes, it's not the wind that kills. It's the wind that causes the damage. It's the flooding, the water that kills. 90% of storm hurricane deaths are water-related. 90%. You're going to die drowning if you're going to die in a hurricane. So let us say Irene was a little stronger and was hugged the coast a little bit more, went up Broadway. It went up Wall Street.
Yeah. The Long Island Express.
It is. It is the Long Island Express. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And obviously, luckily, at that point, there were no Occupy Wall Street people to be hurt. But if you look at Battery Park and Wall Street, that is a storm surge hell. If we took that, a Category 3 storm, not even a Category 5, a minor major storm, and bring it up Wall Street, bring it up New Jersey, maybe let it sit there for a while, and then up to Boston, you know, near Cary, and you. What would it do to the insurance industry?
We would see a number of bankrupt insurers this year because that would have come on the heels of many billion-dollar storms that they were not expecting in places like Missouri, in places like Texas. And it's also happening against a backdrop of a really awful year for insurer investments. I mean, their investment portfolios, just like everybody else's, got whacked. So on top of that, if you had that, I mean, that's a realistic disaster scenario of the order that Lloyd's of London asks their carriers to prove that they can remain solvent in. A hurricane that moves its way up the East Coast through the densest economic value in the United States. They are extremely lucky that it wasn't as strong as it could have been, because we'd have a number of companies out of business today.
And so, Hal, it's been 20 years since we had a true major. I mean, you've had Wilma, you've had
Katrina.
What?
Katrina and Wilma
Katrina.
Came through here. Right.
But
they
were, you know, they were no Andrew, and Andrew was only an Andrew for some of the poorest parts of South Florida.
Andrew was very misleading because it was had a forward speed of 20 miles an hour down where the inner part of the eye wall had the onshore surge down near the old international headquarters for Dadeland. There was a, 16.9-foot surge. But two blocks inland, it was only about 2 feet. It was like a big wave came. If that had been slow moving, it would have been catastrophic.
Andrew was slow moving and moved north, maybe.
No, if it had moved up here, we would have done in a few insurance companies, I would guess then.
And what about people? Andrew killed. I used to have that number memorized. I don't have it anymore.
It's small. It was pretty small.
It was, but any idea how many people would have been killed had it been moved up north? Or even gone down the Broward Dade line, because I was in Fort Lauderdale.
I don't know. I mean, we all had friends that were down in Homestead or Florida City that were in the surviving closet of the house. And people, there's an immense survivability. Let me give you my black swan, I guess, I told you to keep your eye on these outlet glaciers and the warm water moving in. That could be our rapid acceleration. The thing that I think should concern us all most is the Arctic pack ice, because it is thinning and losing mass at an amazing rate. It had a record low aerial coverage in 2007. Back in 2000, there are articles that said maybe by 2070 we would lose the Arctic pack ice. And, it's not on? Okay, they said maybe by 2070 we would lose the Arctic pack ice in the summer, and now there are people saying maybe by 2013 or maybe this decade, and it has become so thin and over the years, and the Arctic Ocean is warming. When that is gone in the summer, we're going to see a yet more rapid warming of the Arctic Ocean that is going to warm Greenland, but more of concern is it's going to warm the tundra and the permafrost and cause decay of unbelievable volumes of organic matter. Ted Shure at University of Florida suggests that by the end of the century we'll have melted maybe 3 meters of the permafrost. That would add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere equivalent to what is presently there. Okay. Right at the time that we're going to get our act together. You're going to squirt me with that, aren't you?
No, I'm not going to squirt you. Actually, I've been at these events, and I know I have the reputation for being the first person at the microphone to ask questions. I'm up here. I can't be down there to ask questions. And you've got to be able to come up with some questions. There's no one at the mics. This is your turn. Don't make me come down there and ask it myself. Or don't make me squirt you. All right. Let's go on this side, and then Jeff.
Hello. Thank you very much for this informative panel. George Gonzalez, University of Miami. My question is with regard to geoengineering, and I know that there was a panel of political elites that not too long ago, maybe a couple of weeks ago, started urging researchers and government to research geoengineering answers to climate change. So instead of focusing on mitigation, because we may very well be beyond the mitigation boundaries in terms of stopping catastrophic global warming, what research is taking place with regard to geoengineering, and what does anybody on the panel have to say about engineering geoengineering solutions to the global warming question?
Okay, yeah. Just to repeat the question, and by the way, SEJ rules as always apply: journalists first, SEJ members and journalists first. So the question is about geoengineering. For those. Just to explain, geoengineering is the concept of, what is the sure way to, let's find a way, since we've put ourselves in a mess, can we technologically fix ourselves in a mess by tinkering with the planet in the opposite direction, by making it cooler? So, Carrie, there's been a lot of geoengineering work in your community, yes. A lot of talk about it. Where do you stand on it? Is it a good idea?
It's a very good idea to be prepared to do it. It's not necessarily a good idea to do it. Most of my colleagues consider it the method of last resort. The problem with it, ironically, is it's too cheap and easy to do. We could cool the climate starting tomorrow if we wanted to, but at some risk. And the reason to do research is it's not that expensive to do it, putting sulfur in the stratosphere where we've already had the experiment done for us naturally by volcanoes. That's how volcanoes cool the climate. It's cheap enough that a moderate or even small-sized nation could decide to do it unilaterally. And because of that, there's a fear that it will be done unilaterally, and because of that, we better be prepared to understand the consequences and be able to argue, if necessary, against them. There are all kinds of downsides and risks to geoengineering. It's a political nightmare if you wanted to try to do it rationally. But yes, there's a lot of research, and it is a route. But it has a lot of downsides.
Okay, let's go to Margaret. And one question to add to that is, what is our track record when it comes down to tinkering with stuff? Do we do a good job of that?
Well, so unintended consequences applies to almost every field of science and technology. Well, I can remember when nuke power was going to be too cheap to meter, and by the time we needed to dispose of the waste, we would have worked out what we were going to do with the waste. Oh, yeah, that was 1950. So this is, as Carrie alluded, you know, it's one of the things you need to know something about. It's highly controversial. There is an effort among the international science community to develop standards, at least by which to assess the validity of these experiments. The problem is, like lots of things, there's some real charlatans out there hawking some stuff. And there's also concerns, for instance, we had this debate 50 years ago, 40 years ago in this country around weather modification and decided not to do it. But there's a lot of evidence right now coming in that's suggesting that the Chinese are already engaging in weather modification, to underscore Carrie's last point. So if you don't have an international framework and a way to monitor it, then someone's going to go out and do it to make money or whatever, and then we're all might be screwed. We also might be screwed if we don't understand this kind of approach, because we have, of course, been geoengineering for at least the last 120 years.
And Hal, are you familiar with Project Storm Fury? Could you tell the people about Storm Fury? Okay, well, let me tell you quickly, and then let's go to Hal. Project Storm Fury in the 1960s, anyone who lives in Miami knows the name Bob Sheets. He was the Hurricane Center Director for years.
Didn't know his name.
Bob Sheets, before that, was in charge of something called Project Storm Fury. The idea was we could weaken hurricanes by taking their eyes and making them wider and weaker. You make a storm, in general, weaker that way. The only trouble, but you also make it bigger. And the only trouble when they did their one experiment with that is there were people who would not have been hurt by the normal hurricane, but they were hurt by the larger hurricane that was weaker. And the lawsuits and the legal issues just killed that program right away. Hal, your take on it.
Is this on yet?
Yes.
I do remember that. What were we talking about?
Geoengineering.
There's one aspect of a geoengineering-like thing we have to do, and we have to start getting greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. The carbon dioxide stays in too long. It'll just, for the next 500 or more years, we're going to have a serious problem. We have to get it down. We've already put a lot of heat into the ocean, and that has a great heat capacity, but we have to get the levels down.
And that geoengineering, there's people called Klaus Lochner, David Keith. They go around trying to create essentially giant artificial trees. Okay, now let's go to Jeff.
Jeff Burnside, NBC Miami. Four stunning presentations today. Thank you very much, all of you, I think. And I'm sure there'll be some stories that come out of this session as well. My question to you is, as you toil with your incredible work and the magnitude of the consequences that you are envisioning, how do you react to this frustration that I'm sure you must feel that a huge percentage of the public either don't believe you or don't care? And why is that?
Carrie, why don't you answer that one?
I just last night read a very interesting essay on that topic. You're absolutely right that scientists are incredibly frustrated over this, that we simply haven't been able to reach the public to convey the fact that we face serious risks going forward. We're up against a disinformation campaign, but I will also say, as a result of reading this essay, it's nothing new in science. When there was the Copernican Revolution, It took science a while to accept the fact that we live in a sun-centered solar system. It took 50 to 100 years, but it took another 150 years for the public to accept that. And there were all kinds of revolts against what science was telling them. It's nothing new. The question is what to do about it. And it's frustrating. I have no solutions to propose.
We're now going to go to the lightning round of questions and answers over here. And don't forget to identify yourself and tell us which one of the panelists, only one now panelist, is going to answer your question in 30 seconds or less.
I'm not sure which panelist, sorry. This is Cynthia Barnett, Florida Trend Magazine. Looking at the insurance data, I saw that 16 catastrophic events so far in 2011 in the United States, but none so far in Florida, which is very unusual. Does that fit into any pattern at all, or is it a fluke? Thank you.
Charlene,
I mean, every year the dice get rolled, right? So this was the year that Florida didn't get hit so far. I don't think that that means that Florida gets to breathe a sigh of relief. Now, I guess the question, the challenge for insurance companies, the challenge for policymakers is if you accept that climate change is happening, it means that every time you roll the dice, you don't know what the odds are because the die themselves are being reloaded. They're being reweighted. And that will be, I think, the fundamental challenge going forward, whether it's figuring out how you set insurance rates or how you justify investments in adaptation measures, because no one really knows exactly what the risk is.
And I thought it was because the atmosphere knew we were coming to Miami.
Christy George, independent TV producer from Oregon. I've got two questions. One, very simple. Whenever there's a major disaster, there are always people who say, well, you know, people shouldn't rebuild in New Orleans or Miami or wherever. Is there any place that is safe from disaster? And two, I want to know if anyone has a solution for the problem of money in politics, which is the precursor, I think, to solving the climate problem.
Who wants to tell us where...
Money and politics, and particularly the viciousness of politics, has actually been with us since the inception of our country. I was listening to a fellow who's written a book about James Madison talking about the viciousness of politics back in that day and how we're pretty milquetoast. So I don't know how you separate the government-industrial complex. I think that's a real problem that we have. That's not unique to our country. We just have our special own cowboy way of it.
Hal, is there any place safe?
Well, there's a beautiful park in British Columbia, Wells Gray Provincial Park, and the campgrounds have 500-year-old cedar trees among you, and you walk through the forest, and it's like you're on a trampoline because it has so wet it hasn't burned. So, but they do have a few earthquakes. I know that.
All right. I'm informed, by the way, if we went outside, which you're not going to do until 2 p.m., there is a very rowdy demonstration outside of hundreds of people demonstrating against federal, state, environmental policies. I didn't know some states actually had, Florida had an environmental policy.
Not under this government anymore.
Jim, over here.
Yeah, hi. Jim Bruggers. I'm a reporter with the Courier Journal in Louisville, Kentucky. That was a fairly depressing round of talks from you folks. I'm wondering if any one of you can give any reason to think that we'll be able to, that globally we'll be able to get our hands around this problem and solve it. And assuming that we may not be able to, what does adaptation look like?
Well, let me back up. I can't answer the first question because I'm a federal employee. But I can answer the last question. You know, for the categories of coastal inundation, drought, and wildfire, everything we want society to do in terms of mitigation, which is also a disaster ghoul term, meaning get your act together and build safer, sounder, have better practices, better roofs, better doors, better locations. Everything we want people to do is exactly the same on this time scale. We don't have to think about climate adaptation. We can just think about disaster mitigation. How do we hold down the ever-escalating costs of today's disasters?
And Jim, actually, to answer your question on optimism, the late Stephen Schneider's, his widow, Terry Root, who's a prominent biologist, climate change herself, told me a story that is just perfect for this. When Steve Schneider was battling cancer, she was sitting in his room, his hospital room, as he was asleep, just sitting there as good spouses do. And the oncology nurse came in and was chatting with her and asked her what she did. And Terry said, well, I study how species are being hurt by climate change. And the oncology nurse turned to her and said, what a depressing job. And Terry laughed as she told the story, by the way. Tom.
Yeah, Tom Henry at the Toledo Blade. I think a lot of people here might be surprised to learn that some of the nation's top tornado researchers, one in particular, Tony Del Genio from NASA, who works with James Hansen, and I can't remember the gentleman at the National Severe Storm Laboratory in Normal, Oklahoma. I think his name might be Hal Jenkins I interviewed, but clearly some of the nation's top tornado researchers have put on the brakes and made a distinction between hurricanes and tornadoes that they are of the belief it's too early for people to jump to any conclusions about cause and effect between climate change when it comes to tornadoes. Hurricanes, yes, because they're much more climatic and a slower thing. Tornadoes are kind of a fluke of nature, and they don't really even know if we're going to have more or less. My question is, this is hard enough for people to get their arms around this issue. You know, the general public and everybody who thinks, can I believe in climate change or not believe in climate change? What level of sophistication do you feel the media has a responsibility to report? Because I've done a couple stories saying what I just said, that you have to make a distinction when it comes to tornadoes, but by and large, people want to, their tendency is every thumbs up, thumbs down, is everything that's weird and wild with weather, is it all because of climate change or not because of climate change? We get accused of being scaremongers, and is it or not? For our own credibility, how sophisticated should we be at making those distinctions?
Carrie, you want to try this one?
Yeah, I suspect the fellow you talked to at the National Severe Storms Lab may have been Harold Brooks.
But Harold Brooks, that's who it was.
In any event, you've described things very accurately. There is no consensus at all in my field about the relationship between tornadoes and climate, which is really simply to say we just plain don't know. Mm-hmm. It's not that we know the opposite. We just don't know. It's a very, very under-researched topic. Now, to your second and important point, I mean, I think maybe Einstein's answer was the best here, is that you should try to make things as simple as possible, but not too simple. In other words, there's a point where simplification becomes disinformation. So it might be simple to say extreme weather events are all going to increase because of climate change. That's too simple. Maybe that will turn out to be true after we do more research. We can't say that now. We'd dearly like to know how tornadoes and hailstorms, for example, respond to climate change, but Harold and Tony Del Genio and the rest of us would tell you, all of us, we just don't know that relationship.
And just for clarification, you're right, it was Harold Brooks, yes.
Okay.
Can I weigh in?
Sure.
As well? I'm not sure if this is on. I think there's also a choice that journalists can make to help the people in their audience understand. You know, maybe there's a very nuanced conversation around tornadoes and the climatology of tornadoes. But it's a choice in helping people also understand the other sorts of perils that they're subject to. People who can have their house destroyed by tornadoes are probably also in regions that are heavily prone to flooding, increasingly prone to flooding now, and to hailstorms and all sorts of other things where the climatology is better understood and where actually you can actually point to the statistics of the events that have taken place and said, you know what, we are seeing worse flooding. And so that's, I think, a really important issue for journalists to wrestle with, especially as we recognize that the American population is trying to figure out what climate change means for them. They've heard a lot about what climate change means for countries like Bangladesh or even Florida. But for somebody in Iowa or Kansas to wrestle with what it means for them, I think that's where it becomes really important to not focus so much on one particular issue that what people take away from it is, oh, nobody knows, so therefore it's not worth thinking about right now.
Let's go over here.
Thanks very much. Rich Blaustein, freelance environmental journalist. My question is, I guess the scenarios of 21 feet by 2100, those emissions business as usual, and would any of you like to weigh in on the PPM number figure? Right now it's maybe 390 parts per million greenhouse gases with an international consensus goal of 450, and there's also a movement for 350 PPM.
Well, the I think we've reached a tipping point that we are in for 5 or 6 or 8 feet. I don't see how we're going to avoid that. I think the mechanisms are in place with the loss of the Arctic pack ice. That's going to warm the Arctic. That's going to give more greenhouse gases. Greenland, the warm waters feeding Greenland and Antarctica are already have a process in place that wasn't in place in the mid-80s. It wasn't visible. And it was, and this has been one of the most shocking eye-openers, I think, of the last decade, is to realize the warm water doing its thing. That's just keeps you awake at night if you hadn't been talking about this for 20 years. So,
okay, and Mark would be a good person here to wrap us all up, since Mark, you would be underwater there. And I actually, let me ask you a question before you ask a question. Why do you live? I mean, we move cities sometimes from flood zones. Why shouldn't we move New Orleans?
Well, to begin with, because the majority of flooding that occurred in the city of New Orleans was a result of engineering failures rather than specifically the storm surge. But secondly, because there are reasons to live in risky communities. That's where the work is and where the jobs are and where the culture is. And if you're a fisherman or if you work for a major port facility on the coast, you're going to want to be there and hope that you will be properly protected. This is a question actually for Kerry. I lucked into an opportunity a couple of years ago where I sort of showed up at AOML on the morning when you entered the lion's den and talked about what your theories were then about hurricanes and to people who were not quite on the same page at that point. But you guys got on the same page. Can you talk a little bit about how that came about and how y'all moved into more cohesion?
I remember that talk very well. I think it was the very first talk I ever gave on the subject of climate change and hurricanes, at least after my initial reports in the 80s. And the particular thing was whether the oscillation, which I showed in the graph in the talk, was owing to changing climate as we usually conceive it, or a natural oscillation. And the major proponents of the natural oscillation idea were from that laboratory. That's why I went to, it was the lion's den for that subject. The answer is that some of them have changed their minds since then. Some of them have not. Science does proceed, as Seth likes to say, not on journalist timescales, somewhat longer timescales, but I think we're beginning to come around to recognize that, at least in the Atlantic, a lot of it is this radiative forcing.
All right. So I want to, if we could all thank this wonderful panel for a truly depressing lunch.